The Guardian.
Okay, just about to go into the new exhibition. Big warning sign outside. Contains frank information and imagery about sex. Sounds intriguing. Let's have a look. Well, first, you've got to walk past some expensive-looking curtains to divert prying eyes from outside. A huge, big sign, bright sign saying sex on it. And there on the screen in front of me, I think at this point it's probably worth mentioning, this podcast will contain graphic language about animals and their sexual habits. And yes, there we go. Three chimpanzees, well, at it. And all of them eating bananas.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast,
philosophers are entertaining dinner companions.
We go right to the limits of science.
We've got puny brains, but given time and given encouragement, there doesn't seem to be anything that they can't tackle.
And then a bit further.
If you have got a sentient computer, even though it's not human, can you fiddle around with it? They're watching your finger on the switch.
Birds and the bees, it's just sexual nature.
We've got dancing mannequins, we've got everything.
Their anal fin is adapted to form a structure called a gonopodium, which is a bit like a penis, basically, and he likes to swim up to the female and poke her with it and try and give her a little parcel of sperm.
We go behind the scenes at a new exhibition.
The urge to reproduce, the urge to sort of perpetuate your genes to survive.
Hedgehogs have something called kamikaze sperm.
Plus, some highlights of this week's science stories.
More airborne allergies up on the moors, and you got more seafood-related allergies down on the coast.
Strip away chemistry from the world, and you're back in the Stone Age.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome back. We start this week with a close look at limits. Is there a limit to what we can know? Does the scientific method run out after a certain point? If there is a limit, how close are we to the edge? And how will we know when we get there? Hoping to answer some of this is our guest this week, Peter Atkins. He's a professor of chemistry at the University of Oxford. He's written the textbook on chemistry, and he's also the author of one of my favourite popular science books, Galileo's Finger, all about the 10 greatest ideas in science. His latest book is called On Being, a scientist's exploration of some of the greatest questions of existence. It's a book that deals with some of the most universal questions around origins, endings, births, and death. Peter, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
In the studio with me also is The Guardian's Nell Bowes. Hello, Nell.
Hello, it's delightful to be here.
And The Observer's Robin McKee.
Hi.
Cheerful-looking chat.
It's great to be here on this wonderful morning.
Let's get on to the meat of this discussion. Now, Peter, you're very optimistic that there's nothing that scientists can't illuminate, that it can actually eventually replace all our myths about the unknown. There are plenty of things, though, that science has no answer for at the moment. Consciousness, the moment of the Big Bang. Do you think it's just a matter of time before we get to all this stuff?
Oh, yes. I think we've got to be optimistic about that. I mean, there are three routes to knowledge. One is relying on ancient texts, which is basically religion. The other is just sitting around thinking about what the world should be like, which is basically what the Greeks did. And the third way is to go out into the world and examine it, do experiments on it, compare notes on it, and build up a network of interrelated ideas. And that last method is science. And there is no better way and no more reliable way of going out and finding out about everything there is.
Now, I'm sure that everyone around this table agrees with that sentiment, but let's just step back a second. The science in its current form, experimentation, you know, sharing of knowledge, all of this, has only really existed in the Western world for the past few hundred years.
And look how much it's achieved.
It has achieved. But why has it taken humanity this long? I mean, the great thought has existed for a long, long, long time before that, thousands of years. So if this is the best way, then how come it took us so long to work it out?
Well, you need liberty of thought. So you need the grip of those in authority and bishops and imams and things like that to decline so that people who think sensibly can go out and think in a liberal way.
What are the hardest edges of scientific knowledge at the moment, the things that you think you know, are quite tough?
Well, there are two really big problems. I mean, there's lots of little problems, of course, but the two big problems are, one, where it all came from, and we haven't got a clue at the moment, and the second is the nature of consciousness, and we don't have a clue about that either. But we're working towards it, and scientists are cautious, imaginative revolutionaries.
Saying that we don't have a clue for something, that isn't the same thing as saying we'll never know.
Oh, absolutely not. We're building up, a database of knowledge. So the physicists and the mathematicians in that fantastic collaboration between them are edging back towards what might be the very beginning of the universe. And the further they get back, the easier it will be for them to build up a model of what preceded the Big Bang.
It is your intention in the book you've written to sort of do away with mythical creation-type stories?
Oh, absolutely. The fact that there are so many myths means that people treat those questions with great seriousness. They really do perturb people. But they are placeholders. They're not actual explanations of what went on. And I think what science is doing is showing that what actually went on, either at the Big Bang or inside your head, is even more wonderful than the myth makers could have imagined. So we're revealing an extraordinarily wonderful field.
Do you ever get the feeling, though, that some things might be just too hard for our brains to comprehend?
There is that worry. But, I mean, the internet helps there, because brains now work in collaboration. Brains have worked in collaboration for a long time, but it's been collaboration over time, with, you know, Newton interacting and providing the basis for Einstein and so on. But now everything is almost instantaneous, and brains are collaborating almost in real time.
So one brain might not be able to comprehend it, but thousands and millions of brains would.
And we've got puny brains, maybe, but given time and given encouragement, there doesn't seem to be anything that they can't tackle.
Nell, do you want to come in?
Well, I was interested in your talking about some incredibly fundamental concepts, the nature of matter and the nature of consciousness and the nature of truth as well, in the way that you're talking about the scientific enterprise. Yeah. But you also talk about philosophers as millstones around the necks of scientists, as pessimists rather than optimists.
Yeah. Philosophers are professional pessimists. That's what they're paid to be.
So hold on. So why are philosophers pessimists but scientists optimists?
Well, I suppose it's part of their upbringing, really, that they're basically pessimistic people.
But they're trying to find answers in the same
way, are they? No, they're not. I mean, I think that philosophers are very good at finding answers to certain types of question, like ethics and so on, and sort of politics, perhaps, which is kind of an extension of ethics. But they're hopeless, absolutely hopeless, when it comes to discovering anything about the real world. And they act as a millstone by urging caution on scientists, and that's absolutely tolerable. But when they go even further than urging caution and saying, there's no hope, don't bother, then that's where they're being, I think, they're out of place.
But I think it would be a generalisation to say that they all say, there's no hope, don't bother. But there's a sort of, is there not an interesting point there that says, in driving forwards and trying to understand things, you need to be conscious of the limits or the ways in which one might be capable of understanding things, and need to factor that in.
Yeah, that's the caution. But one should still say, OK, you urge caution, but I'm so optimistic that we're going to get to
an
answer.
Let's go out and do it.
And the history of the philosophy of science, really, is that philosophers say you can't go down that street. Scientists rush down it, come to the end. So philosophers rush down it, catch them up, find another street that they say you can't go down. But philosophers are entertaining dinner companions.
Wow. Ouch!
That's very kind.
Robin, what do you come in there?
I was interested, you pick on philosophers there, but it's not just philosophers who've had the sort of pessimism. I mean, there's Haldane's, you know, famous remark that the universe is not only queerer than we imagine, it's queerer than we can imagine. And he therefore sets a limit about what we can Yeah. No, you don't believe that.
No, Peter Medwell said also that there are limits to science, but I see no sign of limits. I mean, most of what we regard as outside the bounds of science, like religion, spirituality, and so on, the sense of self, the soul, are open to scientific investigation, in my view, because they are aspects of the psychology of the person who holds those views. Mm-hmm. And although psychology is still a very young and primitive science, it is a science, and it is a way of exploring the way that people think.
Now, Peter, you said that in your book that the humans have to leave behind hopes and vanity to sort of see the true grandeur of the universe. Instead, in a sense, take themselves out of it, show that there's no reason that humans, we humans, I suppose, are always looking for reasons why we are here, why we are in this universe, why the universe was created for us, etc. And I kind of see the point you're making about leaving behind our hopes and vanity. But is it also not a little bit hubristic, perhaps, to think that science can actually answer everything, because we are, in a sense, just an accident on a planet? Why should it be that this method, that this growth on a planet has developed, can actually get to the beginnings of all of this magnitude?
It's wonderful that it has, but I think we shouldn't look for purpose in things. I mean, that takes us down sort of speculative routes, which are a bit pointless, really. I think there's a grandeur in something as huge as the universe just hanging there without purpose. I think to try to impose upon it the human perception of purpose diminishes it somehow.
Looking at the species and how long will it take for us to understand the universe? Slightly more personal question, how confident are you that we will survive long enough to be able to carry out that investigation?
Oh, not at all. No, I'm rather gloomy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are all sorts of pressures on us. I mean, there's internal pressures like fundamentalism and so on, which sort of diminishes our self-respect and imposes constraints on us. I hope that the tide of fundamentalism will not flood over the liberty that science represents. And there is just mankind's stupidity and the fact that it can bomb itself into smithereens. So it is rather depressing. But we can't let that kind of worry about the future stop us from trying to discover while we can. Who knows? We might be wrong.
I mean, in the book also, you don't really deal with the ethics of this endless search for knowledge. I mean, while it might be a good argument to make that we can find all this stuff out, is there any ethical break on whether we should apply this knowledge in a certain way or find this thing out?
Well, there are certainly ethical breaks on how we go about finding things out. I mean, we encountered horrible ways of finding things out during the Second World War, and scientists mustn't do that intrusion into human suffering at themselves. But I think we should just press on, hoping that maturity will come with knowledge.
I was interested in how you talked about ethics as that study of both of ethology of the history of our behaviour and also of the fact that we are capable of looking at consequence and having to analyse those two together. But you then talked about how if we managed to create a artificial consciousness, then we could happily experiment on that. And I was wondering, surely, do you realise that at that point, are we worried ethically about human beings, grey beings, or about conscious beings, in which case isn't it a bit difficult to start experimenting on artificial consciousness?
I think it raises a whole new ballgame of the range of ethics. If you have got a sentient computer, then can you, even though it's not human, can you fiddle around with it?
So this is around whether robots have emotions, is it?
That's all
they have rights.
Yeah, and they're watching your finger on the switch. I mean, that would be very worrying for them.
Given those two things, our consequences and our ethological history, how does one then bind into that, or does one completely ignore the kind of cultural mores from the Yamabs that you referred to before and the other cultural packages of ethical
systems? Some of those are, of course, deplorable. I think it better to understand the foundations of ethics by understanding our evolutionary and ethological history than simply to throw up our arms and say, God, this is so awful, I really must refer to the handbook, be it the Bible or the Quran.
But does that mean you have to throw away the Bible and the Quran?
No, not
as
at
handbooks?
All. I think if you interpret the holy books as collections of anecdotes about people who have confronted problems in the past, and you take a clue to your own behaviour from them, then I see nothing particularly wrong with that. It's when people regard them as unarguable authority that troubles me.
So they're handy as anecdote, not rule book.
Yeah, exactly.
And on that neat place, we'll finish up. Peter's going to be discussing some of these ideas in a lecture at the Royal Institution in London on the 22nd of March. For more information, go to rigb.org. And his book on being is out on the 17th of March. You can find all that detail on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Next up, a little warning for delicate ears. This next feature contains some frank information about the sex lives of the natural world.
I'm Andy Duckworth, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. Well, behind me, I've got a gorilla staring at me on the wall there. There's a sperm whale. And right in front of me, I've got a couple of stuffed rabbits. Well, at it like rabbits. Just over here on another podium, we've got two foxes bottom to bottom. There's a picture on the wall of turtles, well, getting rather chummy. It's all part of a new exhibition here at London's Natural History Museum. It's called Sexual Nature, and yes, I couldn't miss this one.
It's about the diverse techniques that are exploited in the natural world for seduction and reproduction, and we're looking at sex in particular and its relationship with evolution. I'm Tate Greenhalgh, I'm the exhibition curator for the Sexual Nature exhibition at the Natural History Museum. So how sex affects both their body and their behaviour to reproduce as much as possible.
Usually a fairly taboo subject.
Yes, it's a new one for the Natural History Museum. We're going for more of an adult audience. We're very good at family exhibitions, and we're trying to cater a bit more for older audiences. And what better thing to do launching a new series of adult exhibitions than sex?
There we go, some big turtles at it on a big screen. It's too early in the morning for this.
Hello, my name is James McLean, and I'm a fish curator here at the Natural History Museum in London. In the live aquariums we've got, in one there are some fish from Central America called mangrove killifish. And these are incredibly interesting because they are able to produce male and female sex cells within an individual. So if one fish finds itself isolated in a puddle or like a flooded old burrow in the swamp somewhere, it can then lay fertile eggs, and within a few months that puddle or whatever will be full of young killifish.
There must have been some discussion as to whether it was right for the museum.
No, not really. I think sex is such an important part of life and so intrinsic to evolution in many ways. It really keys into everything that the museum does. And what's brilliant about this exhibition, it brings together all different parts of the museum's collections, which are extremely diverse. And we're able to put a huge amount of specimens into this exhibition, all demonstrating weird and wonderful sex lives of animals and plants.
If we avoid the shagging bunnies, if we go over to the red deer, there's a red deer over here, which is rather... It's a fantastic specimen. It shows the species in the rutting season. So its head's thrown back, its mouth is open, it's bellowing, it's roaring, it's letting the females know that it's ready to mate. I'm Richard Sabin, I'm Senior Curator of Mammals at the Natural History Museum.
The name sperm whale, does that have anything to do with this exhibition?
Well, now you mention it. It is quite appropriate, but unfortunately, we didn't think of that. No, it was just that the sperm whale is probably one of the most exaggerated examples of size difference between males and females. I mean, the males are up to 40% larger than the females. The name sperm whale actually comes from the spermaceti organ, which is like an oil-filled sac that sits on the head of the animal. And whalers back in the 18th and 19th century, when they cut these things open, when the oil was exposed to the air, it would turn a kind of a milky colour, so they mistakenly thought it was a sperm reservoir.
Well, just describe what area of the exhibition you've brought us to, one of your favourite areas.
Yes, well, this is the most intriguing of all. This is the section about sperm competition. So the competition doesn't end once you've had sex. Then for the males, the sperm take over the competition in the race for the eggs of the female. And they've come up with all sorts of devious ways. This is the dark side of sex. So whether it's penis shape, which is extremely important. So we've got specimens of damselflies, which have very peculiarly shaped penises, almost like scoops. So they can take out any sperm that have already been deposited inside the female before they put in their own. So they're taking away the competition there. Others, such as hedgehogs, and we've got some specially commissioned taxidermy of hedgehogs mating. Hedgehogs have something called kamikaze sperm, which is quite common. So up to 90% of sperm in some species actually isn't racing for the eggs. It's soldier sperm that tries to, in the case of the hedgehogs, it forms a vaginal block inside the female so that no other sperm can get through.
In the other tank of live specimens, we have some guppies, which are also from Central America, and they're very interesting to watch. The males are quite relentless in their pursuit of the females. They're always sort of swimming up to them and prodding them, and they have their anal fin is adapted to form a structure called a gonopodium, which is a bit like a penis, basically, and he likes to swim up to the female and poke her with it and try and give her a little parcel of sperm. But sometimes if that isn't working, he has to be a bit more subtle and sort of swim in front of her and do a nice display and flash off his colours, and maybe that'll beguile her.
With foxes, they get stuck together. That's a form of mate guarding. So the male stays with the female until his sperm have had time to get to the eggs, so ahead in the race before she mates with somebody else. And what happens is that the female cervix clamps down on the penis, preventing them from separating. So the male has to then cock his leg over after mounting the female so that they can wait it out back to back. And that's how our foxes are positioned here.
Antelopes, are they? Are they antelopes? That looks pretty violent.
Whoa.
Ow.
My pin-up specimen here is the Argus pheasant around the corner that you might have seen when you came in.
Okay, let's do that, shall we?
That's my style. It's an old mount from sort of mid-1800s, and it's been mounted in this kind of great big fanned-out display, and the whole thing is nearly 2 metres from head to tip of its tail. I'm Jo Cooper. I'm one of the curators in the bird section. Why we've got this one in here is to show off kind of historical aspect to sexual selection and ideas about it, because of the bird's connections with Darwin. Darwin looked at the display of the Argus pheasant, the patterning in the feathers, to kind of explore ideas of, you know, why should birds, or indeed other animals, have these really elaborate markings? Because we perceive them as beautiful. Did that mean that there was, you know, a kind of a designer behind it who also saw them as beautiful? What was the function? So these kind of birds like this, the peacock, really were posing those problems to Darwin, and Darwin was able to answer those through developing his ideas on sexual selection, having already been looking at natural selection.
These are things that would be detrimental to survival, but really advantageous to getting laid. Let's go over there again.
So I guess this is the human side,
yes,
is it?
Yeah. We've concluded the exhibition really with a whole section indulging humans' ideas about sex, and really we've separated this out from the rest of the exhibition largely because the human sexual behaviour is this complex interaction between not only our biology but culture and so many other influences that separate us from animals, and there's no real scientific consensus for why we behave because it's so complex. So we put together some of the ideas and concepts from evolutionary psychologists, but it's such a changing field, there's really no definite answers. So we're really posing questions to the public and asking them what sex means to them.
Hello and welcome to Lonely Hearts Are Us.
There's some telephones, there's a magnetic board. What does that have to do with sex?
This is all to do with the language of love, and this is something quite unique to humans. We've got a chatterplane board. The telephones are playing Lonely Hearts adverts that are from real forums.
Hi, I'm 32, slim, and 5'2". I love to travel and be outdoors, and I'm open to pretty much anything. I want an affair that gives us both what we're missing.
So they're people's own words describing what they're looking for in a sexual partner, and there's a huge diversity.
What kind of sexual partner are you most interested in? Please select one of the following options. For other women, dial 1. For men, dial 2. For couples, dial 3.
And we've got a couple of questions here, I guess, for the public coming in. Do you believe in true love? Yes, no, maybe. And should humans be monogamous? Yes, no, and sometimes. Should get some interesting results.
Yes, it should be interesting. It would be great if we could make this some sort of scientific survey, but we can't control it tightly enough for it to really be that. But it will be intriguing, nonetheless, to see how the voting goes.
Please hang up. Thank you.
The exhibition, Sexual Nature, is now open at London's Natural History Museum. There's also a beautiful audio slideshow of what you can see there. Go to guardian.co.uk/audio slideshows. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, go to @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all of the Guardian science content, follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Okay, it's show and tell time. Everyone in the studio has brought in a story from the week to discuss. Now, you've got a story about mapping allergies with places in Britain.
Yeah, it's a group from Plymouth who've mapped allergies over the southwest of the UK. They looked at GP referrals over about a decade. They took about 6,000 referrals and then mapped the type of the allergy and the geographical location. And they found that you did get clusters of different types of allergy in different areas, so that you tended to get more airborne allergies up on the moors and you got more seafood-related allergies down on the coast.
So what does this tell us for the fact that we should be prescribing certain things in certain areas, people should avoid certain areas if you've got a, I don't know,
well, there was an idea. It's very difficult to know what environmental causes are and how they're associated with allergies. So this was just the very first in a step to try and say, all right, if environmental causes do have an effect on allergies, then can we map them? Can we see how different allergies might affect them? But in fact, one of the things that they really got out of the study was the fact that education of GPs might be a good idea, as the range of referrals and the different types of nature of referral varied hugely over that whole
area. You mean they
area.
Didn't recognise particular allergens?
So they didn't either recognise, or they didn't send for diagnosis, or about 44% of people in the UK say that they have an allergy, and only about half of those have actually been diagnosed with one. And one GP surgery referred 27 people, and the next GP surgery in that locality, the most people they referred was 7. So there's clearly, those were within very close areas, so there's clearly a lot of difference in how it's being tackled right at the GP level.
I'd love one of these people, what we need is more research. I'd like some group to come along and say, actually, no, we're done.
We don't need any more research. That's it.
Don't bother giving us any more money, and we're just going to go home now.
We've sorted it.
Yeah.
You could do it on the web as well. You could just say, have you got a particular allergy?
Yeah.
And just send it to a central database.
Your self-reporting might be quite difficult.
Well, that would be revealing anyway.
It would be, certainly.
I mean, how defined are allergies? I mean, if a GP refers a patient to a specialist clinic, just because they're suspicious there's an allergy, not because they know there's one.
So out of the 6,000 referrals, about 900 actually were diagnosed as having allergies.
So you can't even GPs can't diagnose allergies. Take that as the headline from this.
Not fair.
And is the number of allergies increasing?
Certainly the number of people referred to hospital with anaphylactic shock, an extreme reaction, has increased over the last 5 years.
Okay, well, let's leave that there before someone gets allergic to this podcast. Come on, put some sound effect behind that, please.
Sorry.
I want to bring in a story too. It's about a story that came out last week from the University of Oxford. So researchers there are working on a universal vaccine for influenza. Every season, a flu shot has to be designed for that year's circulating strain. These things change all the time. It's difficult to inoculate everyone in time. And occasionally, as in 2000 and 9-10, you had a pandemic with one particular strain of swine flu that started off in Mexico. And so, you know, the idea of a vaccine that can deal with all this stuff is you know, tantalizing. So this is a group led by Adrian Hill at the Jenner Institute in Oxford. And one of the research teams there is led by Dr. Sarah Gilbert. And she's been working on trying to find some place on the flu, all strains of flu that have been conserved all these years, to try and target that pace to try and make this universal vaccine.
What are they actually targeting?
So a normal flu vaccine, in fact, almost every vaccine in the world operates by taking some analog of the proteins outside of the virus and inserting that into the immune system and making the immune system make antibodies. And the antibodies will then recognize that protein. So when a virus comes along in future, it'll kill the virus. The problem with flu, of course, is that it mutates all the time. Every single season, the proteins are slightly different. So
but it's the external proteins.
External proteins. And so they change a lot, and this is the problem. Now, what this group in Oxford have done, and it's an interesting new technology, they want to target the proteins inside the virus. There are certain proteins inside the virus. One's called nucleoprotein, another one, matrix protein 1. And these are inside the virus, and they're necessary to keep the DNA intact, essentially. And so they can't change very much. And in fact, they're about 90% the same across all virus flu strains. And they haven't changed in decades. So if you can target those, you'll get all of the flu viruses. And so what they've done is to find a way of targeting those using another thing in the body's immune system. Instead of making antibodies, the body also makes T cells. Now, T cells are another particle that go around finding infected cells and killing them. But they need to recognize that these infected cells are either foreign or infected. So what the vaccine can do is train T cells to recognize these two proteins. What they've done now, the reason we reported it last week, is that they've managed to do a challenge trial where what you do is you vaccinate someone with this T cell vaccine. Notice that actually the number of T cells is going up. So that's positive. And the second thing you do is you infect that person with flu to see if it works. And what they found is that fewer people who are vaccinated got the flu than others. And I'm being told to shut up now. Right, let's move on to another.
That's that finger is. I was wondering.
Anyway, more on that.
From the top, start again.
More on that story on the Guardian's website if you're interested. Now, this year, 2011, it has many anniversaries. We spoke last week about the 50th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin and Ham the Astro Chimp's voyage into space. Robin, is there another thing that's important this year?
Well, we've got the conquest of the South Pole at the end of the year. But before that, we've got the 100th anniversary of Madame Curie getting the Nobel Prize for chemistry, which leads us to, in a sense, another event, which is the International Year of Chemistry, which is 2011. It seems perhaps, you know, a good time to talk about chemistry, given that we've got Peter here. And so mine is not so much a story as a sort of open invitation to Peter to just I'm talking. Sorry. I'm talking. Just be quiet. I've had enough of you today. Chemistry. I mean, physics. We've had physics, astronomy. It gets all the money. It gets all the bucks. It gets all the attention. The Hubble Space Telescope and the Large Hadron Collider, whose name I wasn't supposed to mention today, gets all the news. Chemistry, is it that, you know, it's become a forgotten orphan of the scientific world? Do you think that, Peter?
Well, if you forget it, then what are you left with? I mean, what chemistry does is to provide the material infrastructure of everything that you've just mentioned. It provides the materials from which everything is constructed. It provides the medicines that prevent us from experiencing pain and so on. There is nothing in the world that is tangible that has not been contributed by chemistry. So it's an amazing subject, really. But it's a kind of a background subject. You know, there are the chemists producing materials which perhaps don't exist anywhere else in the universe, and providing opportunities for people to build the extraordinary electronic devices that, you know, make life so interesting, as well as all the fabrics that clothe us, the fertilizers that feed us, and so on. Strip away chemistry from the world, and you're back in the Stone Age.
I mean, do you think we pay sufficient attention and spend enough money on chemistry and chemical research in this country? Are we, I mean, we were once preeminent at it.
Yeah.
But I'll be losing ground. For, I mean, China has a tremendous reputation now for material sciences. How do you see that situation?
Well, I think it's a real worry. Recently in China, seeing the number of institutions set up just for materials research, amazing investment, and they will certainly take over the world. You know, we're losing the pharmaceutical companies in this country, which is a profound worry, because there's a trickle-down effect that people don't go into chemistry because they think that they're not going to get jobs at the end of it anyway. So it's a serious worry. And much of the industry of this country, much of the export industry of this country has been built on the backs of chemists.
Given the brilliant description you've just given of how important chemistry is to the fabric of modern society, and how important it will be for solving things like climate change, coming up with new materials for batteries and all sorts of things, does it annoy you when you see adverts on television and people talking about how chemicals are something evil and how there's no chemicals in this food, and that chemicals have come nowhere near this natural product?
I mean, if you substitute chemicals by physicals. Then, you know, cars banging into each other.
This does not obey the laws of physics. It's natural
and
products.
So on. I mean, it's a real worry.
But what it shows.
I think that physicals probably, and maybe biologicals probably kill more people than chemicals do.
Well, biologicals are seen as something nice, aren't they? But chemicals, I mean, yeah. It is. But on a more serious point, I mean, this is worrying, that newspapers, radio programs, TV, the stuff that people see, if they're not confronted and are interested in science themselves, they see chemicals as something to get rid of.
Yeah. I mean, that's a problem for all of us. What we have to do is to admit that sometimes we cause disaster. Think of Bhopal and things like that. But we are also the only people who can prevent that sort of disaster. And what you have to do is judge whether the extraordinary world that chemistry provides through the materials that it invents and then creates is worth the candle. It's a question of balance. And chemists don't go about trying to pollute the world, but they do go about trying to improve it. And it's very regrettable that in the process accidents happen.
One last question. The International Union of Chemistry, have you got a chemical hero or heroine? Who would you favour?
Michael Faraday, mustn't it?
Right.
Who was...
He was a physicist as well.
Yes, but
you're claiming him for the chemists.
but he combined extraordinary experimental powers with extraordinary passion for communicating science to the general public. And so taking the two together, I think he's a real scientific hero.
Do you have one, Robin?
I've got a real passion for Madame Curie, as it were.
Wow.
I thought she was wonderful.
You must have met her a long time ago.
Shut up.
Mine's Antoine Lavoisier.
Oh, Lavoisier is a good one. I'm going to have
shame
to say.
To him, shamefully cut, had his head cut off. But what
I'm
going
to have to say Atkins, of course, because it was the early morning dread of that textbook. It lives on in my brain.
So you've read Physical Chemistry.
Wow. Oh, it's associated with bad, bad mornings.
What a generous environment this is.
Cool,
in a very positive way. It's a privilege to me.
Everyone should read Physical Chemistry, and we should investigate Robin's passion for Madame Curie a bit later, probably. We can read all these stories on our blog, of course, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast while you're there, so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. That's it for this week. Thanks to Peter Atkins. His talk at the Royal Institution takes place on the 22nd of March. More details at rigb.org. And his book, On Being, is published by Oxford University Press on March the 17th. Thanks also to Nell Bowes and Robin McKee. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Yep. Two chimpanzees at it while eating a banana. What do we have here? Oh, this is a little bit more serene. A wasp or a bee. That's quite romantic, really. I think I've just seen a tortoise penis. And there the giraffes go. Whoa. It's very elaborate. Very elaborate. Interesting. Might try that at the disco this weekend. The disco.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.